You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
And thank you very much to everyone for attending. Izvinite, another govori po-anglisky. So, just by word of background, I'm working on a book project at the moment called Great Games, Local Rules, the China-U.S.-Russia Struggle for Central Asia. And so this book project emerged from a fellowship I had last year with Open Society studying the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and looking at both in an academic sense what this organization is and in a policy sense how should the West respond to it, both in Washington and Brussels. And although I didn't intend the project to become a book, of course, inevitably it became a book, given some other things that were going on last year, especially what happened in Kyrgyzstan, U.S. concerns over the Manas base, and so forth. So I'm happy to touch upon other aspects of Central Asia, too, if you would like, in the Q&A. But I do want to focus on what is the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as I perceive it, a Western academic perceives it. How has the West thought about it, right? And how has that evolved? And I think you'll see great differences. And what are, from my perspective, again, my limited perspective, some of the difficulties that the organization encounters as it tries to evolve? So as you see here, this is a map of Central Asia. You see the Shanghai Organization has its own distinct logo. Its headquarters are, paradoxically perhaps, they're in Beijing, which is, I guess, but calling it, you know, the New York Cooperation Organization and having it stationed in Washington. But there you go. And it's, of course, composed of Russia, China, and four out of the five Central Asian republics. Turkmenistan is always neutral, so they're outside, right? And this is the organization that succeeded the so-called Shanghai Five, without Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Kazakhstan, that concluded old Sino-Soviet border disputes in the 1990s. And this organization in 2001 became the SCO when it added Uzbekistan and formally became an international organization as opposed to a forum. Let me show you what prompted me as a scholar to take great interest in the organization. This is a mission statement from China National News Service in August 2007. What is the SCO? And here's the quote for you. You can talk about the democratization of international relations, and then in my emphasis, I'm talking about the Shanghai spirit. It is of immense significance in the search of the international community for the establishment of a new type of international relations. So this is, you know, quite a powerful mission statement coming from Beijing. In other words, this isn't just a forum for regional issues. It's something quite distinct in the practice of international relations, potentially. And so I want to try and interrogate that claim a little bit, too. So I want to give you three distinct views in the West, and by the West I mean both the EU and the US, of what the SCO is. I want to evaluate the empirical record and trends, and then talk a little bit about emerging EU, US, NATO attitudes towards the SCO, and if we have time, some concluding remarks. So the number one and the first view of the SCO when people started thinking about the SCO was in 2005. And the initial reactions to the SCO in the West, especially in Washington, were overwhelmingly hostile. The first sort of prism was that the SCO is an anti-Western bloc. And this is a result of the 2005 Astana Declaration on U.S. military bases. At the Astana Summit in July 2005, the SCO declared that U.S. bases in Central Asia had served their purposes and they should be put on a timetable for removal. Just a few days afterwards, the government of Uzbekistan issued an eviction notice to the U.S. Perceptions were crystallized when Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of State, said of the Astana Declaration, "It seems to me like the two big boys in the club are trying to bully the smaller one," right, in reference to China and Russia and Uzbekistan. Now, we know now that things happened quite differently at Astana. That in fact, it was President Karimov who took his proposal first to President Putin and then to the other members to whether to include this declaration, and the others agree, some more reluctantly than others. But in any case, the perception crystallized among some in the think tank community in Washington that was the SCO now a new type of Sino-Russian alliance to try and push out the West from its military presence in Central Asia. Also recall that at that time, Afghanistan was relatively stable. Central Asia itself was relatively unstable from the view of many Central Asian governments, that this was in the middle of the so-called colored revolutions and regime changes and so forth that hit Central Asia in March 2005 and Tulip Revolution in Kyrgyzstan. So some of the scholarly literature has attempted to explain the SCO as an example of soft balancing against the U.S., in other words, not hard military balancing, but the denial of access rights, basing rights, the sort of the attempt to diplomatically limit what the U.S. can and can't do. So Steve Walk, Bob Pate have made these arguments in reference to the SCO. And then there was also concern when in 2006 and also a little bit 2007, there was open talk of a possible energy club. The SCO wanted to be an energy club, possibly set up a natural gas cartel with Iranian involvement, and that would effectively amount to control of 65% of the world's natural gas resources. So there were some alarming memos written at that time, too. Well, 3 years later, it's an I would say this is quite an important marker. We saw that what seemed to be a Russian-Chinese alignment at the time of 2005 became a little more split. And this was as a result of the impact of the Georgia War. Not so much that Russia intervened militarily. Most Chinese scholars and analysts I've spoken to thought that was Russia's sort of prerogative to do, but rather the question of recognition of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, that this was a line in the sand that China was not willing to follow. The Chinese are very concerned about precedents that are set on the issue of recognitions of independence. And so President Medvedev, in his attempt to try and get SCO backing for the recognition of Abkhazia and South Ossetia at the Dushanbe summit in 2008 was met with quite stiff resistance and a statement that reaffirmed the territorial integrity of states in the post-Soviet space. And at that point, afterwards, I noticed a shift in talking about the SCO to talking about the CSTO on the Russian side, that it's the CSTO that's the preferred security forum. It's the CSTO that should engage with NATO. It's the CSTO that should try and be involved in Afghanistan and somehow in this sort of, trying to get away from the SCO. So I think the aftermath of the Georgia War is quite important. And I think, just to be provocative here, a year later, in 2009, following the Urumqi riots, you saw China almost immediately go to all the SCO countries and request a strong statement supporting Chinese intervention and the crackdown in Urumqi. And they got it within 24 hours, right? An SCO declaration. Yes, this is China's business. It's prerogative to defend its territorial integrity in any way it sees fit, and we support it. So, the contrast there, I think, is revealing about whose security agenda the SCO has been serving. Of course, there are other elements, too. The U.S. is back militarily after being evicted from K2. It was always in Bishkek and Manas under troubled circumstances, but since 2008, we've had the establishment of the so-called Northern Distribution Network, which is an attempt to get away from the problems of supplying U.S. and NATO forces exclusively in Afghanistan from the Pakistan route, the sort of Karachi up there. Now, you'll see what great lengths this alternate route really goes to, sort of literally and figuratively. NDN North begins in Riga. It goes all the way by rail through transiting through Russian territory. One spur goes over through Kazakhstan, the other one through Uzbekistan, but they all terminate in Termez. That's the key, right? Now, formally, the U.S. Military is not operating out of any bases. It's relying on commercial contracting arrangements with companies. But there are some interesting variants here. So, for instance, it's not on the map, but in the heart of Uzbekistan, there's the airport of Navoi, which was recently refurbished by South Korean company Hanjin, a sort of parent company of South Korean Air, whose traffic volume has tripled over the last year. And if you believe reporters like Deborah Tienen from Eurasianet, they have argued that that arrangement is being used as a logistical supply hub for the U.S. military, but it's done so on commercial terms so that the Uzbeks can deny that the U.S. is directly involved and so forth. So the point I want to make is that the U.S. military is actively involved in its logistical effort. Also, there are still military-to-military training programs that go on with the Central Asian states, opening of training centers and construction of new facilities, especially in Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. I'd be happy to talk about any of these issues in the Q&A. But the point is that the U.S. military is back, right? Despite the SCO declarations, this anti-Western military presence has not been borne out. A second view of the SCO is that the SCO is an authoritarian club, right? That it promotes so-called anti-democratic values and authoritarianism. Tom Ambrosio has written books and articles on this. He espouses this view. Amnesty International has come out with a few reports on this. The China Human Rights Center, I think, is going to be presenting something at the Council on Foreign Relations next week, along these lines, too, talking about the domestic political impact of the SCO. And so these scholars have, and commentators, have talked about the Shanghai spirit being opposed to Western liberal values, that the Shanghai spirit embodies sovereign non-interference in the domestic affairs of countries and condones political repression. It privileges state power over civil society. Now, why exactly do they say this? Well, enshrined in the SCO is the sort of combating three evils principle, right? So the mission security statement of the SCO is to combat the three evils in the region. The evils are separatism, terrorism, and extremism. Now, one of the interesting dimensions of the SCO is that they have a regional anti-terrorism center, RATS as it's called, in Tashkent. And one of the things RATS does is it coordinates activities amongst the internal security services of the countries. It's actually not subject to the jurisdiction of central offices in Beijing. RATS is actually directly subordinate to the relevant ministries of interior. So it's part of the SCO, but it's not part of the SCO supranational, as far as it exists, structure. But in any case, one of the criticisms that's been made of RATS is that they keep a common list of extremist groups in the region, and despite the fact that they promised to release publicly who's on this list and so forth, they have yet to do so. A lot of human rights advocates talk about possibly some legitimate groups and dissidents might be on that list and so forth. Another point is that the SCO sends election monitors to national elections in these countries. Their conclusions tend to be quite different than the OSCE ODIHR monitors out there. And then there's also been criticism of human rights and rendition policies that bypass national extradition procedures that are conducted under the SCO anti-terrorism treaty. And here, mostly the accusations have been about Central Asians, handed over Central Asian security services from Russia and from each other, and Uyghurs handed over from Central Asian countries over to China. So this is a goal. I would just make a couple of quick points on this. I think norms, this kind of idea of norms and political values, it can change quite quickly, right? So if you recall ASEAN at the very beginning, it faced a very similar labeling, right? The ASEAN's a club for dictators, for authoritarian polities, and now the organization's very much developed. It actually has democratic principles enshrined in it, or, you know, the Organization of African Unity, now in its new incarnation, has also embodied those norms. So norms are variable, and so I'm not sure that that's necessarily going to hold over the medium and long term. Finally, and I think this is the more interesting, for me anyway, view, and this is the one I want to discuss more substantially, is could the SCO be a regional public goods provider? Could it facilitate regional integration, the provision of common economic projects, infrastructure development, and so forth, that is so desperately needed in Central Asia? And this is the view that's been expressed most forcefully by Oksana Antonenko in London. Also, Marcel De Haas has written a number of op-eds and commentaries. And they both talk about how the EU and the West should not hesitate from cooperating with the SCO, because the SCO is this dynamic organization that can bring much-needed investment and facilitate integration in the region. Different aspects of this, from border resolution, economic cooperation, trade, infrastructure, communications, as a partner for Afghanistan, and so forth. So, has the SCO been a public goods provider? And I think the answer is no. That there have been many proposals that were initially floated. 2005-2006, there was talk of possibly creating a regional investment bank under SCO auspices that would unite the various national development banks into a regional bank. That's also been revived recently, but as yet, that has yet to sort of form. There's a so-called list of 125 projects that could be SCO projects, but the fact of the matter, that list has mostly been financed through bilateral Chinese projects rather than multilateral projects. And one of the things that really threw me as a researcher and took me a long time to understand is sometimes Beijing refers to investments and projects in Central Asia as SCO projects when in fact they're bilateral investments. And so they use the words Central Asia and SCO almost interchangeably, and that muddles the waters a little bit. But the point is that the Business Council, the interbank mechanism, are not robust. They're not operating at that level. There was also a lack of coordination on response to the financial crisis, that China from October 2008 wanted to create an anti-crisis fund of about $10 billion. Russia was more hesitant about this. Instead, it preferred to go through Evrosec, gave Belarus a loan, gave Kyrgyzstan a bilateral loan. And then in Yekaterinburg, China once again offered to Russia the opportunity, $5 billion each, equal share, equal control. Russia reportedly turned down the offer, and the Chinese went ahead and they did $10 billion anyway, and so still soliciting and considering proposals. Another aspect of this, about this time, is that the financial crisis is hit. And as you know, the financial crisis had a deep impact on Russia, and of course Russia's capacity to invest abroad in some of the projects that it had promised. In China, not quite the opposite, but China actually made significant progress in its investments during the financial crisis in Central Asia. The $10 billion loan and investment package concluded with the Kazakh government, the $4 billion loan and investment package concluded with the Turkmen government, each had aspects of energy to them. And just here's some data I've compiled on Central Asian trade annually. And you see, sort of 2001-2009, you see the lines crossing, that China, Russia had been steadily ahead of China in terms of its overall trade, and now those trend lines have crossed, and China is now overtaking, in official terms anyway, Russian investments. I think if we included unofficial shuttle trade between places like Kazakhstan and China and Kyrgyzstan and China, this would be even wider. So this, sorry, I talked about this already prematurely. I think sort of the Chinese-Russian economic agendas has been one source of sort of the SCO not developing the public goods agenda. The other one, though, is the Central Asian states itself, themselves, that borders in Central Asia remain, as I would term, highly commercialized. That the informal barriers to trade, to economic integration, remain prohibitively high. Institutionalized corruption in state agencies, customs, border guards, security services, and that although a number of agreements are signed, the capacity to implement them is quite low. And you know, you see numerous newspaper articles about just how long it takes to cross. I should have had another map here. Some of these particular checkpoints, but averages 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, and so forth. Incidentally, one of the hopes of the proponents of the Northern Distribution Network, people writing about this, Fred Starr and Andy Cutchins and so forth, in the UCSIS report, talk about that maybe NDN can reinvigorate the Silk Route, right? It can sort of include in increased trade and regional integration that way. I'm more skeptical because I'm not sure that NDN itself can surpass, again, the problem of sort of borders as toll booths in these places. And I actually could make the opposite argument that, in fact, because certain shipments are protected because they're associated with NDN, then border guards will feel compelled to skim even more from the non-protected shipments. So actually NDN might end up actually depressing trade as opposed to increasing it. This is an empirical issue. We can observe the data and the trends, I think, 1 or 2 years from now and see who's right. So what then of emerging views of the SEO? So the EU is quite mixed. EU officials support the public goods dimension, of course. I mean, they're one of the pioneers of regional integration, and they think regional integration in general is a good thing that should be supported. They are disappointed in the lack of progress on trade, infrastructure, and economic development. The values issue is a difficult one still for the EU, and especially this business of separatism, that the EU just doesn't agree that separatism is an evil, the way that it's expressed in the SEO charter. Also, there was a concern about Ahmadinejad being given a role at SEO summits. That's no longer the case, as it seems as if the criteria for membership have been defined in such a way that restricts Iran or prevents Iran from joining anytime soon. So that concern has dropped out. But this issue of minority rights and separatism is one that high-level EU officials take problems with. Now, or have problems with. Now, every 6 months, sometimes you have certain EU countries that seem to get quite excited about the prospect of having, say, a high-level ministerial summit and conference with the SEO. This was the case of Spain, came in with the EU chairmanship. Of course, last year, the SEO summit was going to be in Tashkent, and then the Spanish were eager to enhance their relationships with Uzbekistan and so forth. But attempts to create higher-level contacts, more institutionalized contacts, they really ran into a wall of opposition in a number of working groups, in the European Parliament, and so forth, and again, mostly on the values agenda. And also, the EU already has a EU-China bilateral forum where they consider they can bring up certain issues and concerns that deal with the SEO in that institutional mechanism, so they feel as if there's no loss with waiting a little bit. NATO's very interesting. It's very interesting, and I have to confess, when I began the research, I wasn't expecting what are, I think, more mixed findings about NATO. That, yes, in 2005 and 2006, there was serious concern about the SEO, obviously, as it had taken this hardline position against Western military bases in the region. In fact, all NATO countries except Germany lost their basing rights in Uzbekistan by the end of 2005. The Germans kept theirs. But now the position has changed, and NATO itself has downgraded the values dimension in dealing with Central Asia, in part because it requires NDN. It's vital for the Afghanistan campaign to supply the routes. And I say potentially positive. There isn't whole-scale agreement. Different NATO officials think different things. Different countries think different things. But there is an openness to thinking about what cooperation with the SEO would look like, specifically on the issue of Afghanistan. And I think this was reiterated just a few days ago by Assistant Secretary of State Robert Blake, who was in China, in Beijing, and talked specifically about trying to strengthen China's role in Afghanistan vis-a-vis the SEO. And is there a potential mechanism there? Part of the problem is I think everyone's divided on the SCO in Afghanistan internally. So you see splits within the U.S. government on whether the SCO could be a viable partner or not. You see splits within China of whether they should engage and assist the effort in Afghanistan or not. Some people have termed this in terms of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs versus the PLA and the military and how much support they should bring. So, but you see this willingness at least to think about and talk about engaging very different than where we were 5-6 years ago. They also see the SCO as potentially enhancing the sovereignty of the Central Asian states, which remains an official policy of the United States and other countries. And they see the SCO, dealing with SCO, as preferable to dealing with the CSTO, right, given the choice between the two. So the kind of terms of engagement, I think this issue is very much in flux. I'm sorry I don't have a stronger conclusion for you. I think Western international organizations will respond to the SCO according to their different priorities. It depends on what they view as the SCO competences, how important the values issue is, and what the regional strategy is. In my opinion, it seems at the moment the EU seems to be trending against engagement, but there's always the possibility that could change, and that NATO and the EU-US is trending towards engagement. But that could possibly change. And again, I think the situation is quite fluid and quite dynamic, but as Afghanistan assumes a greater and greater role, especially in U.S. Foreign policy and security, I think there's a sense that U.S. requires as many regional partners as it can muster, and China and Russia and the Central Asian countries themselves are all part of the picture. So I will leave it at that, and I look forward to your questions and conclusions. This is just sort of theoretical stuff here. Yep.
Great, and you've stayed within the limit, for which I'm also grateful. So why don't we open it up immediately to first to questions on the presentation or on informational questions,
sure.
And then we'll move from there into discussion. If you do ask questions, I would ask that for the sake of the recording, just so that we can then make a record of this, that you speak into the microphone, which will be distributed, and that you introduce yourself as we may not all be familiar with each other. Please.
I'm Richard from GIMO. I would like to ask you about you. Do you see any potential for CSTO and SCO cooperation? Because in October and November of 2010, there has been some dialogue. Can you comment on that, please?
Right. So I think people in this room are probably more qualified to answer that than I am. I hear about different cooperation mechanisms being set forth. It's not the first time it's tried. I hear that relations between the two offices are quite good, that they exchange information and so forth. I think the question is, what are going to be the functional differences between the two groups and organizations, right? What is the security, how is the security mandate of the SCO going to differ than the security mandate of the CSTO? And I would just sort of point to the Kyrgyz crisis, the recent Kyrgyz crisis, as an interesting test case, I think, of both the difficulties of the SCO and the CSTO to respond to, I think, some of the security challenges that you see in the region. Let me put up the map so we can all have this to see. And really, the sort of CSTO's inability to intervene, despite an original request from then interim premier Otunbayeva, raises, I think, some serious issues. Sort of, under what circumstances would these rapid reaction forces be activated in Central Asia? And I think the SCO performed even more poorly in the sense that they didn't even talk about intervention, right? And they've trained, the peace missions that they had were for a scenario very much like this: a regime change, a terrorist takeover, something like this, some sort of internal collapse. And China, I think, quite intentionally stayed out of events in Kyrgyzstan for April and the summer, seeing this
as a Russian-U.S. struggle and tension, and waiting to see until everything settled down to deal with it. And then welcomed Kyrgyzstan and the new government in once it became clear that they, in fact, were going to be there. So I think there's a couple of issues there. What is going to be the functional difference between the two organizations, and how effective are they really going to be in times of crisis? It's not clear to me yet.
Thank you. More questions? Please.
Elena Kirichenko, MMO. Do you see any perspective for free trade zone in the framework of this organization?
Thank you for your question. I personally don't think it will happen. Beijing would very much like it to happen. And that's my short answer, that I think China would very much like to use the organization to expand its economic agenda, whether it's project financing, infrastructure building and development, investments in hydroelectric power to connect to Xinjiang. But not only Russia, but especially the Central Asian states are very hesitant. Already this chart I showed about increased Chinese involvement in Central Asia, the Central Asian states certainly welcome Chinese money and investment and loans, and especially infrastructure development, which they need. On the other hand, there is a fear lurking. You know, where does all this go? What happens in 20 or 25 years when the loans are due? You know, what does China want out of the region? So there is, I think, some hesitation that already the region at the micro level is really being taken over by Chinese business and Chinese traders. If you go, say, to Karasu, the big open-air market there, I think, you know, the percentage of traders now that are Chinese is up to 50% almost, if not over, just within the space of a few years. And then that's true of the other big markets also in Central Asia. So I think there's a real hesitancy about opening the door even more. One very interesting, if I may, issue to observe is what happens to Kyrgyzstan economically. And there has been some talk of the possibility of bringing Kyrgyzstan into the customs union, right? Kyrgyzstan is China's big export hub and re-export hub. In other words, about 90-95% of all Chinese trade with Kyrgyzstan is not for Kyrgyz consumption, it's for re-export to the rest of the region. So, you know, will there be an attempt there to sort of take China's economic sort of base away? You know, I don't know. But there is hesitancy on the part of the Central Asian states themselves about formally reducing economic barriers under the SEO framework. Certain projects, yes, on a selected basis, maybe certain sectors, but free trade still not really on the agenda.
Thank you. Maybe while people are digesting some of this and coming up with other questions, I can abuse the microphone in front of me. You mentioned the split that occurred in 2008 over the question of recognition.
Yes.
What I'm wondering, and maybe I don't know whether we know this or whether it's knowable, I think it's interesting to wonder whether the reaction of SCO members in Central Asia and their decision not to support Russia on recognition, whether that was directly lobbied for by Beijing, or whether there was a tacit understanding that Beijing would simply not be happy with it, or simply for their own. I mean, each of these other governments has its own reasons not to be particularly happy with recognition.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And I think both happened, right? So I think on the one hand, you did have some active lobbying by Chinese representatives there. There's also a reported meeting between the members of the Chinese delegation and the U.S. ambassador at Dushanbe Airport. Perhaps that can be verified over this exact issue. But your point about this not being in these countries' interests is also a valid one. That is, from a couple of Central Asian countries, who were involved in emergency meetings, one of them said to me, we decide this is just not in our national interest, right, sort of thinking about this. And if other countries toe the line, you know, we will certainly join in. The other issue to bear in mind is this issue of passportization didn't go over very well. Mm-hmm. In other words, the logic that Russia was defending Russian citizens abroad because they had Russian passports, Central Asian governments were very hesitant to accept that as a justification for intervention because of, you know, the large Russian diasporas in some of these places. So that was another region. So it was both. It was mm-hmm. both.
Thank you. Please.
Andriy Ostwald, Center for Cross-Cultural Communications. Mr. Kuli, what is your opinion about the future of Kyrgyzstan as an independent state?
Right. Thank you for your question. That's a very interesting and very difficult topic to answer. Let me say that I hope Kyrgyzstan makes it as an independent state. I have great affection for the people there, for what they're trying to do, and I think just for the question of political stability and order in the region, it's important that Kyrgyzstan makes it as an independent state. As an analyst, I have to confess that I have my doubts, that I think the challenges are great, and it's not just a question of north-south divisions. You know, we all know about the north-south divide, both culturally and physically and so forth. It's also a question that after 20 years, there's real institutional, I would say, malformation in the country, that the corruption is so bad, that it's so impoverished, that a lot of very well-intentioned people, they come to power, and it's just impossible to resist temptations of the system. And what I see in Kyrgyzstan, also in Tajikistan, is it's much easier to grab as much as you can, as quickly as you can, and then get out, than it is to sort of make a lasting investment and so forth. And so, you know, the Bakiyevs were very good at manipulating Russian and U.S. geopolitical interests for their own gain. They almost perfected it, but in doing so, they really impoverished the country and tore it apart. You're seeing, you know, Atambayev, Prime Minister, you know, in the recent sort of discussions with Prime Minister Putin, talking about the fuel contracts and, you know, MENA Corporation and getting rid of those, in part because they want a new Kyrgyz state company to control those. So I guess it's a long-winded way of saying I don't see a lot of actors acting in the national interest in Kyrgyzstan. And I think that's the problem, that you put these figures in positions of power and authority, and it's very difficult for them to act in other ways. So I'm pessimistic. The other point I would make, just very briefly, and I think there's a very good crisis group report on this, recent one, is that the infrastructure in Kyrgyzstan is in such bad, such a poor state, that you actually have, you know, power plants, dams, roads, in really a state of disrepair, and also the people who can run a lot of these facilities are now quite old and are about to retire, and so that's a concern. No, not to mention the general level degradation, social investment, education, and hospitals, and so forth. So I'm rooting for Kyrgyzstan, but I'm afraid I'm pessimistic for the moment.
Please. Why don't we take, I saw a few hands, so why don't we collect maybe three questions,
sure.
Four questions, yeah. And then bring it back.
Yeah.
Emilia Jaszuk, Embassy of Poland in Moscow. I must confess, last summer I made a trip all around Central Asia. So this issue of Central Asian countries is for me has also a different perspective. But my question is connected to Fergana Valley. Mm-hmm. We know that Fergana is Fergana Valley is divided according to state borders that breed a lot of instability. And these borders also separate ethnic groups completely. How do you see this situation of border division develop in the future? Do you have any scenarios? And the second question is connected to OSH events of June. Uzbekistan has behaved quite moderately and did not escalate the pressure, did not escalate violence. How do you see Uzbekistan as a future actor in the region? Thank you.
Please.
Thank you. Atamali, Association for Euro-Atlantic Cooperation, Russia. Mr. Kuhnle, I would like to comment on one of the points in your presentation. While the Western fear about more closer strategic relations between China and Russia is quite understandable, true, the West doesn't have very many levers or ways or possibilities to influence Chinese position in many ways. But at the same time, West has a very, very developed and structurized relations with Russia through European Union, NATO-Russia special relations, US-Russia special relations, whatever. So why not to try to use its good relations in general, I mean positive relations with Russia in order to influence the so-called Shanghai spirit or SEO from within, and also why not to try to deal directly with this organization? I mean, it's always better to talk than ignore. Thank you.
Sorry, what was the last part?
It's always better to talk than ignore.
Oh, right, talk than ignore. Mm.
Thank you.
Please.
Versus Lomaitis, Embassy of Slovakia. I have a short question. Do you think that the SEO can play a constructive role in beefing up Afghanistan's security? And if yes, what exactly would you have in mind? What kind of projects or initiatives?
I'll take two more over here and then bring it back to Alex.
So thank you very much for your presentation. I'm Vladimir Rybachenko from Moscow Institute of Technology and Physics. So first, I have a question. As you know, CSTO was proposing many times to cooperate with NATO, but NATO is very reluctant. What could be the reasons? And second, I would like to make another comment. When you mentioned about the recognition of these two republics, you explained, and I understand what you were saying, about the reluctance of these republics or these countries to recognize them. But also you used the word passportization. And to a certain extent, one could understand that as if the people living in Abkhazia and South Ossetia were forced to take this passport. Here, I wouldn't expand too much on historical context, but it's very important to remember whose part they were 100 years and 2 years ago. And please do not forget what was happening when President Gamsa Hurdi came to power, who announced Georgia to Georgian only. So I think this is a very important aspect, and one shouldn't think that Russia has forced people of Abkhazia and South Ossetia to take this passport. I think they were doing this by their own will, most of them. Thank you.
Thank you.
And last question, then we'll bring it back.
Vadim Kazulin from Peer Center. As we know, soon the coalition forces will start withdrawal from Afghanistan. And there are some expectations that it might dramatically change the situation in Central Asia. There are fears about security in this region. What do you think about it, and how it might influence Western or NATO attitude towards SCO and the opposite?
Oh,
Thank you.
Long list of easy questions.
Yeah, right. Oh, these are great. These are great. I'm not sure I have any definitive answers, but I'll try. On the Fergana Valley, this is of immense concern, and I would use a superlative like that. The potential for instability has always been there. We've seen flare-ups in different parts over the last decade. And I would identify a number of trends, not only sort of the rising lack of central authority in parts of Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, the question of high food prices that's coming up now, I think over the next year, is going to be the domestic issue, especially in this part of the world. I think another variable is migrants, especially in Russia. How many of them stay? How many of them go back? And how many of them go back to Fergana in a state of no economic opportunities and unemployment and so forth? So yes, the potential is there. By some accounts, Hizb ut-Tahrir has used the instability in Kyrgyzstan to try and create a new center of operations in the south and so forth. I don't know if that's true or not. But the point being, in ungoverned sort of areas or areas outside of central control, different groups can emerge and they can play different kinds of roles. On Uzbekistan's behavior, I have to say I agree with you. And I've, as someone who's written publicly very critical things of the Uzbek government before, since we're on the record here, I'll commend the Uzbek government for its restraint that it showed. My sense is that President Karimov was pressured by his military advisors to intervene. I think, I don't know how to put this without getting myself in trouble. I think restricting access to information about what was going on and the scale that it was going on probably served to reduce public expectations of an intervention, and so it made it easier for him to show restraint. And he did open that part of Uzbekistan to the international humanitarian community for a week anyway. So all of these things, I think, were positive steps. Whether they would be restrained in the future, I don't know. I mean, one issue to bear in mind is Uzbekistan would not have been thrilled with a CSTO or any external intervention in southern Kyrgyzstan, right? If anyone's going to intervene, they want to be the ones to do it. And it's not enamored either with this OSCE proposal. First it was to send a few hundred trainers, then it was 50. Now I think it's 30 that they still haven't been able to get there. So the Uzbeks are in a delicate situation. They showed restraint. They do consider it to be their backyard. But if anyone is going to handle it from outside, I think they would have real problems with that. Right? They want to be the ones that manage the situation. I think your question about Western policy, China and Russia, is a very astute one, and your point is a very astute one. And my response would be that there is very little systematic thinking about this. And part of this is a Cold War legacy. Part of this is that you have the reflexively anyone but Russia crowd, and especially when it comes to this part of the world, right? So the U.S. official position remains, we will strengthen the sovereignty and independence of the post-Soviet states. So if anyone else is building a pipeline, that's something we support. If anyone else is investing, that's something we support. Now, you know, I don't have a slide of this, I apologize, but, you know, if we take the new Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, China pipeline, well, okay, this diversifies Chinese energy supplies. So in some ways, maybe on a very, you know, macro sense, that's good. But wait a minute. Now, the Turkmens have just committed to 40 BCM, 50 BCM, 60 BCM by one account. Is there going to be gas in Turkmenistan to go the other way? So this is just one example. I'm thinking reflexively, anyone but Russia for many is sort of the doctrine to follow. And I think the triangular relationship requires a great deal more nuance as you described it, that I think the U.S. would be well advised to try and work with Russia, I think, and work within, I think, sort of existing sort of institutional sort of infrastructures to, I think, reassure and help Russia. The other aspect of this is we do not have a good policy for how, or strategy, let alone policy, on what we should do about Chinese soft power. We just don't. We don't talk about it. We don't publicly debate it, really. Well, we talk about China and Africa, sort of, because it's out there in Africa. But this is something that's not been thought through, and I think the point is raised about Central Asia, that China, very slowly, very steadily, is displacing a system of kind of international governance that the West has been very accustomed to controlling. And I don't think that's a fight anyone or most people in D.C. want to pick right now. But I think your point is absolutely key, and I think there more nuanced strategic thinking about what the elements of a triangular relationship, how they operate, is certainly needed. Afghanistan security, what could the SCO do? Well, they do anti-narcotics trafficking programs, and these are considered relatively good as far as they go. I mean, if you want to be cynical, there are members in the SCO, weaker, poorer countries, that don't want to be completely successful, I would say, in the anti-narcotics trafficking campaign. But from border specialists I've talked to, these are serious programs, actually, and they're doing some good. Other things that have been talked about, possible training of the Afghan military, that could be a role. You know, the big issue is sort of this question of, I think, eradication versus sort of interdiction, right? Would the SCO, you know, get into some sort of eradication project? And I think that would run into the very similar obstacles or political problems that the NATO attempts to eradicate poppy growing in Afghanistan did. In other words, it's not very politically popular. Other things people have talked about, maybe the SCO could convene a process, a forum for reconciliation domestically. That's on the more ambitious side, but certainly some SCO commentators have talked about that, and bring parties together, modeled, some say, on the Tajik reconciliation process. But that's again, on the more advanced side. Passportization, I certainly didn't mean to imply that they were receiving these passports in a forced way, and that's not how I used it. I think the point was more about using the justification of citizenship as a justification for military intervention. You know, I'm someone who's talked about the need for the West to engage more with Abkhazia as opposed to less, and to try and find a way outside of this passport conundrum on the Abkhaz issue that we have. That, you know, I think there's definite models for it out there, and I know this isn't related to Central Asia, but I'll just, you know, something like, you know, Northern Cyprus, right, where the EU doesn't do this, but the US and the UK do. You know, someone goes over, and if you want to get a visa on your Northern Turkish Cypriot passport, you can get one, but it's issued, the stamp in there is a Republic of Cyprus U.S. Embassy sort of stamp, and that's the way they manage the situation. So you know, my wish would be, you know, to try and find some sort of working arrangement so that Abkhaz could travel, that they wouldn't have to rely on their Russian passports to travel. But, you know, politically this is going to be very difficult and very sensitive. And then I think, you know, you have the most difficult question at all over what the security situation, well, a very important question, but very difficult question on what the security situation will look like after the U.S. withdraws soon, if the U.S. withdraws soon. I'm still not convinced that this can't be pushed back even more. I think I'll just make some observations as opposed to predictions. One observation is my sense is still that the Central Asian countries themselves don't look at Afghanistan as a mortal security threat. They just don't. They talk about it in public terms that way. They talk about being part of the public, you know, the international coalition. Obviously, they're concerned with elements and radicals being supported, finding safe havens and so forth, but not in an existential way. They see Afghanistan as not necessarily remote, but something that can be instrumentalized, right, to obtain more U.S. support, commercial contracts, you know, public and private goods related with the sort of logistical campaign, and so forth. And, you know, I would just say in sort of the defense of that claim that, you know, we just wouldn't have the kind of periodic politicization about Manas that we do if, you know, say the Kyrgyz authorities really believed that Afghanistan was a pressing existential national security issue. Instead, it's viewed in different terms, in economic terms. So until that happens, I'm not sure robust planning can start to take place afterwards. Now, China is very different. China is thinking about the long term. And part of its strategy post-Afghanistan is it wants to make sure it has good relations, of course, with the Afghan government, and also that it can expand potential trade and supply routes across the map, not only eastward to China, but also westward and southward, and take advantage of those in the event of the U.S. Withdrawing and sort of Afghanistan independence starting to set in. So in some ways, I think the Chinese are positioning themselves in the region for the long term much more methodically and much more strategically than the Central Asian countries themselves. But I think the situation is extraordinarily dynamic and extraordinarily tricky to track, so I'll just cover myself there.
Thanks. Why don't we turn it over to discussions.
You didn't answer my question about possible relations between CSTO and NATO.
You're right, I didn't. Sorry. What prevents them? I think there's a lot of hesitancy amongst some NATO countries of directly engaging in an organization that they perceive as dominated by Russia. I think that's the very basic reason. And you know, in the SCO, I think they see a mechanism that's more regional and where sort of, you know, the presence of China as a sort of balancing force would be easier to deal with, or perhaps they feel sort of more productive to deal with. So, yeah.
Thank you. Comments, ideas, thoughts, contributions, please.
Andrei Oswald, one little comment for the question of passports for Abkhazia people. When I worked in Abkhazia in 2004, an election of president of Abkhazia, I was told not one time by officials and ordinary people that the reason is very simple. If you have Russian passport, you get, if you are old enough, you get pension from Russia.
Right.
This pension is much bigger than Abkhazian, was much bigger, 10, 20, or maybe more times. It was absolutely simple.
Right. No, good point. Thank you.
Please.
Hi, my name is Michelle Manson from the Australian Embassy. I just wanted to get your views on political succession issues in the Central Asian republics, particularly noting, I guess, the different experiences of Turkmenistan versus Kyrgyzstan. And then now when we look at what President Nazarbayev is doing in Kazakhstan, seems not to be looking long-term. But some people must be just interested in your views.
Yeah, right. Right, where to start? I think your point, the way you phrased the question, is something I would agree with. In other words, it's going to vary. And I think in part on the kind of institutional and economic structure of these places. In other words, you know, Turkmenistan, would I personally like to see greater liberalization? Absolutely, right, on all fronts. Will Turkmenistan be unstable as a result? I don't think so, right? I think whoever you plug in, just because the population is small, because they do have a guaranteed revenue, they can spread enough around to enough people to remain stable. Now, this doesn't take away from a number of social problems that Turkmenistan has, but I don't see it as a prime candidate for instability or collapse or anything. I think that the division I would make between the oil and gas producers and the others, right? So I actually think in Kazakhstan too, my sense is you're not going to get broad-based social mobilization no matter what the outcome of this election. I don't think, you know, much is in doubt. You know, the sort of diffusion or contagion effect of the Middle East, even though the Central Asian rulers are concerned about it, really hasn't hit them. And there's a few reasons for them. First, unlike the colored revolutions, they don't consider North Africa really to be their neighborhood. Two, the level of penetration of social networking, right, blogs, tweets, this kind of thing. First of all, you know, I don't buy the argument that Twitter brought Egypt down. So let me just get that out of the way. But you know, when you look at a place like Uzbekistan or Turkmenistan, they are really the least connected places in the world. So the possibility of diffusion to take place, or for people to voice or to mobilize on a big scale, just isn't there in the same way. Also, I think you've seen some preemptive measures in some of these places. So I generally think Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan will be okay. Yes, succession is an issue, especially in the Kazakh case. But I think they're okay in spite of their politics, not because of it. Right? Put it that way. Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan is a very different issue. Here I'm really pessimistic. And because, in part, they don't have these steady revenue streams to create client networks, bases of sort of patrimonial support, to shore up domestic alliances and so forth, you have this dynamic now, and Central Asians absolutely hate it when I make Africa comparisons, but I'll go ahead and do it anyway. Very similar to what you had in Africa 20 years after independence there, that we've seen sort of these institutions hollowed out in such a way that revenues have just become ad hoc kinds of sources. So what do? You compete for things like, you know, base-related rents and, you know, military assistance and, you know, IMF loans and emergency funding and whatever really you can grab, you try and get. And that's not really a sort of a long-term type of strategy. And I think you're seeing the unraveling of both the Kyrgyz and the Tajik state as a result. I think the big question mark is Uzbekistan. Will Uzbekistan go the unraveling route that you're seeing of its weaker neighbors? Or is there enough in place there after Karimov to sort of stabilize the situation like Turkmenistan, perhaps like Kazakhstan? And there, maybe your answer is that it might be a country that's more divided, that you might have more potential for social mobilization and protests in the east, in the Fergana Valley, even as the succession is managed. From what I can see, the president's eldest daughter is not interested anymore in taking over, right? She has a good life overseas, has companies, has different projects, has kind of humanitarian concerns and so forth. And it doesn't seem as if that positioning is going on anymore. So it's not obvious to me who the emerging candidate is going to be in Uzbekistan. So I think it's a very long-winded answer of saying I think it's going to vary regionally. And probably the type of economic revenue is going to be a big determinant of it.
Well, so I guess the question moving forward then, as we look at that problematic landscape, is have Beijing and Moscow learned the lessons of their failure to be relevant in Kyrgyzstan as they think about the possibility of these sorts of situations arising in future? Does it become in the interest of Washington, Brussels, and others to see Beijing and Moscow be relevant in the region in a way that they were not structurally
right.
In Kyrgyzstan? As a result, I think this sort of research and conversation is too rare, but incredibly useful and hopefully drives both the analytical and the policy process forward. I would suggest that we discuss the answer to that question informally as we can proceed to light refreshments through those doors. In the back, I'd like to thank Alex. I'd like to thank all of you for your participation. Some of you, I hope to see you again tomorrow as we talk about another problematic international formation, otherwise known as BRIC. But the conversation here always continues. So thank you.